It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Carrie Kaufman. You've heard of the sandwich generation. People are raising their kids and caring for their aging parents. A similar concept applies to personal finance. Last week, we covered frequently asked questions for people who are just starting out in their financial lives. Next up on Your Money, conversations about aging and the stages of middle-aged adults. They're pulling their pocketbooks together with an eye on making progress and saving for future decades. Kevin McKinley is a financial planner and managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. He joins us this morning from WPR's studio in Eau Claire. What is your finance question? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. So, Kevin, what are we covering today?
Well, we are going to spend our last few shows here, Carrie, talking about the ages and stages. And today it's going to be middle-aged adults and some of the problems that we face, saving for college, paying for college, saving for retirement, and because many times those of us who are in the middle, the sandwich generation, as you said, are responsible for the well-being of people older than us and younger than us. And so we're also going to talk about protecting your identity, because not only do you need to worry about your credit report and your Social Security number, but you might need to worry about it for a young adult or an older adult in your life.
So let's start with the perennial saving for college. I mean, you know, you get to be middle age and maybe you get you own a house, you have some equity, and then those people that you're raising say, hey, I want to go to college.
Right. You do all this to try to enhance their knowledge and their education, and then
yes,
you end up paying for it. If you just plop them in front of their iPad for 8 hours a day for 18 years, you hopefully wouldn't need to worry about it. But no,
one of the
common misnomers about paying for college is that everybody else whose kid is graduating from high school and going off to a two-year school or four-year school has this giant golf tournament winning size check that they're ready to just hand over to the school. And the fact is that most of the people don't pay for college with just cash and have it all saved up right in front. And in fact, because I've done this now for 30 years as a financial planner, I went back and I tried to look at clients I had who had actually paid for college for their kids. And I realized that they didn't pay for it with a check. They did it through several different methods and over a long period of time. So I broke it down and called it the four ways to save and pay for college. And we use a number of $80,000, because today that's about the net cost of 4 years of college at most schools, or the schools that most kids attend. And it was actually profiled in a little known paper called the New York Times about a year and a half ago. And so we break it down into four ways to save and pay for 4 years of college.
Okay, so what's the first way?
And that is parent or grandparent savings. Now, typically, we've talked a lot about 529 plans, the EdVest account for Wisconsin residents. This is better for grandparents who have a little extra money to set aside, or for wealthier parents who have all of their other goals taken care of. They're saving enough for retirement. They have enough cash on side set aside for emergencies. They have no credit card debt out or anything like that. Otherwise, if you are a parent and you don't feel like you have those things set aside, probably shouldn't use a 529 until you've maximized your Roth IRA contributions. And the reason we like the Roth IRA is because you can borrow money to pay for college, but you cannot borrow to pay for your retirement. So you have to put retirement as your first priority. And the great thing about the Roth IRA is you don't get a tax break when you put money into it, but you can pull the contributions back out whenever you want, for any reason, at any time, for any type of purpose whatsoever. So if you save money in the Roth IRA, and then by the time your kid is ready to go to college, you realize, you say, wow, I have enough money to retire, I've got everything else paid for, you can pull the contributions back out of the Roth IRA. And it's less important what you save, and the more important that you not only save, but you start saving. Because to get one-fourth of $80,000, that's $20,000. And if you're going to earn a hypothetical return of 6% per year, and you're starting at the kid's birth, by the time she's 18, you only had to have saved about $50 a month. Mm-hmm. But if you waited until she was 5 years old, you'd have to save $85 a month. And if you wait until she's 10 years old, you would have had to save $160 per month at 6% per year to reach $20,000 by the time she reaches 18.
So do most colleges actually charge people who go to school $80,000, or do colleges, that's just kind of the sticker price and people get a deal?
Actually, that's kind of the net price. And it really is, it's ubiquitous, because even, we'll talk about this, but even private schools that have a sticker price of, you know, $54,000 a year, the Ivy Leagues are mostly need blind, meaning that if you get in, you are going to be able to afford to pay. You might have to pay some money, but if you don't have enough money, you'll get enough financial aid to cover the costs. Other private schools that aren't quite the Ivy League level, they often discount the price down to a point where most families can afford to get into it. It's still a lot of money, and they have to come up with money, but the net cost is usually about $20,000, regardless of the institution.
So what's the second method for saving and paying?
That's the parent income while the kid is in school, and that's $20,000 over 4 years, which sounds like a lot of money, but it works out to about $400 per month. And you have to remember, if you help pay your kid's tuition, you can get a tax break on that cost. And your kid is out of the house and eating someplace else, so your grocery bill is going to go down a commensurate amount as well. And if you get him off of your auto insurance and call your insurance and say, hey, he's not going to be driving anymore, he's not in the house, a lot of times you'll see your insurance premiums go down enough to where it can more than offset the cost of subsidizing the kid's education while he's in school.
But the kid would have to pay the auto insurance.
If he's going to drive, right.
Okay. The third leg of the plan?
Third leg of the plan is the student working. Again, $20,000 over 4 years at about $8 or $9 an hour. That's 12 hours per week year-round. Or if the kid doesn't work during school, she can earn that amount working full-time during the summer. Again, $20,000 over 4 years, about $5,000 per year.
Interesting. So the fourth and final portion of this plan.
And that would be student loans. And I we're going to talk a little bit about this, but I recommend that all families get the federal student loans. And if you get about $5,000 per year in student loans, that's about $20,000, which sounds like a lot of money, but that's way below the median amount that college graduates who have debt have when they get out. The median amount is actually about $30,000. And this student can pay off $20,000 in student loans by making a payment of $200 per month for 10 years. And again, $200 is not nothing, but it's still something. It's only $2,400 per year, and hopefully that degree will enhance your earnings much more than that $2,400 will cost you.
Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. We are talking with Kevin today about financial issues faced by middle-aged adults, including paying for college. Give us your call. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We've had a couple of people call in, Kevin. Jean from Brown County says that her 24-year-old son graduated with a good job and no debt, and now he can't get a credit card because he has no credit history. So how can he establish that?
Yeah, that's actually a common problem, and it's a good problem to have because it means that they haven't run up a bunch of debt already, but it also means that the credit card companies and other lenders have no history on which to decide if this person is a worthy credit risk. So what they should do is a couple different things. Is a parent can put a kid on their own credit card as an authorized user, but they don't necessarily have to give the kid the credit card. They just have to say, I give the kid authorization to it, and any charges on here I will pay for. The other thing that they can do is kind of co-sign for a credit card. Go to the credit card company and explain the issue at hand, or your local credit union or bank, and say, I'd like my kid to get his or her own credit card account. I will co-sign on it, meaning I will pay for it. And once that account is tied to the kid's social security number, he or she will start building credit really quickly, and especially all they have to do is make the minimum payments on time, and it won't take usually more than about 6 months or so of that activity before the score is established, and then lenders can start to say, all right, we're going to start, for better or for worse, we're going to give you credit on your own merits and let you handle it.
Wendy from Appleton emails, I'm 55. I often pay bills online, but I still keep old-fashioned paper copies going back a year just in case. Someone told me keeping paper copies is more dangerous in terms of identity theft than online accounts. Should I shred those paper copies after paying?
Yeah, especially if they have the records still established online. And you know, that's true on a one-to-one basis, meaning that the information is probably more vulnerable, that it can be taken out of your mailbox, or it can be, you know, if you're negligent when you're throwing the stuff away, you put it in the garbage or you put it in the recycling, and there's an account number or some kind of card number on it that you're not, that someone else could pick up. But I still think I'm more concerned about things online because it's harder to break into. But once into the scalability of the data is a positive and a negative, meaning that the thieves can get access to a lot of information at once if they're able to crack the security wall.
We are talking about financial issues with Kevin McKinley. We're talking about the issues that face middle-aged adults who are squeezed between their kids who want to go to college and need help starting their lives and their parents who are getting to the end of their lives and often need attention and sometimes financial assistance themselves. We are taking your calls, 800-642-1234, and we'll talk more about this in a moment. It's The Morning Show. We are talking this week with Kevin McKinley about financial issues faced by middle-aged adults, including paying for college. And we're taking your calls, 800-642-1234. On Your Money at WPR.org is the email address, or you can always tweet us at WPR Mornings. So we're past the saving part. We're going to write checks. We're going to make those electronic funds transferred to colleges. What is critical here, Kevin?
Yeah, once we start talking about ready to pay for college, it's most important that kids get a degree, and it's more important that they have a degree rather than where it's from. And especially as we know as we go through life, Carrie, fewer and fewer people start asking or caring about where we have a degree, and to a greater extent, they stop caring if you have a degree. But when you're just starting out, it's better to get the degree. And several studies have shown that the cost versus the benefit of a particular institution generally is not in line. Even when people say, well, Harvard graduates earn way more money than, say, somebody at a local state school, the reason that is often because you have to be an exceptionally brilliant, driven individual to get into Harvard in the first place. Mm-hmm. You have to have great connections. You often come from a family of wealth. And so a lot of those things are what actually leads to your great achievement rather than what the piece of paper says on it. So always think about what are we getting out of this particular institution versus what is the cost? And then there are ways to cut the overall cost once you've decided on a particular school.
So I'm going to cut in here and go to Krista in Milwaukee because I think she speaks to this ways to cut the overall cost. Krista, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to say that what my family did was we all did our first 2 years at a community college, and it saved us a ton of money, literally tens of thousands of dollars. And it also gave us the opportunity where if, in my case, you know, you don't know what you want to major in, you get to take a bunch of different classes without having to pay the university cost.
Community college, Kevin. I know a lot of people who are doing that. Thank you very much, Krista.
Yes, Krista, that's a wonderful point, and I'm glad you brought that up because a lot of people who don't know, again, think that everybody goes to this one school for 4 years, and they wear the sweater around, and get the logo tattooed, and that's actually not the way most people get their education, especially these days. Kids transfer back and forth all the time. My daughter will be a sophomore in college this fall, and it was amazing how many of kids in her class went off to find institutions all over the Midwest and the country, and then after a year they came back. Man, they said, it wasn't for me, so I decided to change this. It might have been the major, might have been the school, might have been they just had a bad dorm mate, but a lot of kids are much more open to transferring, and if you and your family are willing to do that or have to do it. Krista's idea is fantastic because half the cost of college is living expenses. Uh-huh. It's the dorm and it's food and it's transportation. And so if you can live at home while you're going to school and getting community college, or better yet, accumulate those credits while you're in high school by taking AP classes. Many high schools have programs where they tie into a local two-year school or a four-year school, and they offer high school students college credit there. Any credits you can get while you're living at home and before you take it saves you money, allows you to stay at home, live off of mom and dad, and even go to a two-year school if there's one nearby that you can stay at home at, and then transfer. And then the best way to save half the cost of college, if you're going to a four-year school, is live at home. Might not be the most fun, might create a little acrimony between the parents and the kid, but it can save you $40,000 over 4 years.
So one of the things that parents have to do, since we're talking about this middle-aged section here, is kind of let go if that happens. If your child, if you're 18-year-old, 19-year-old child is living at home, you have to kind of let them be them. That's a hard thing to do.
Right. You have to set down some rules and say, okay, this, you can't come in at 3 o'clock in the morning. You can't have random people stopping by or anything like that, but we will give you until midnight. And then if you are going to be staying at a friend's house, just let us know so we don't pace the floors worrying about you.
Yeah, that is true. So we talked a little bit about that sticker price, that $80,000 sticker mm-hmm. price. But what are some of the ways that you can actually get financial aid and lower that price?
There's another myth out there that schools just have billions of dollars sitting around waiting to hand out to the moderately above average student who comes along and who's really a good kid and volunteered for 2 hours and has a 3-point-something grade point average. And the truth is that's really not out there. Most schools are looking for exceptional students because they already have lots of applicants who fit that particular profile. And oftentimes the schools that do give the most amount of merit aid, if you will, to those kids generally are really struggling to get people in and are trying to draw people in for that. So academic and merit-based aid is not common, especially in state schools, which already have a relatively low price. Some private schools, though, will equalize the cost. So you might look at a private college and say, gee, the sticker price, as we mentioned, is $50,000. It's still okay to apply to that anyway, because a lot of times there are awards you can get if you get into the school that will help mitigate that cost and put it back down close to what you'd pay if you were to go to a public school. But to get any financial aid, you have to apply at fafsa.ed.gov. fafsa.ed.gov. We'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today. You have to do it after October 1st, before the next fall. So if you have a kid who's graduating in 2019, after October 1st is when you would want to start filling out the financial aid. And then always take those federal student loans, because the interest rate is relatively low. It's relatively easy to get the money. And then if you find out that the kid has more than enough money to pay for her college expenses, you can pay the loans off. But it's difficult to go back in and borrow money that you could have borrowed when she was a freshman or a sophomore.
So FAFSA is fafsa.ed.gov. And that's your, like, your key. That's your portal to all financial aid, not just particular government financial aid, but anybody that's going to give you money is going to look at that FAFSA.
Yep, that's where you start, because that is most schools. There's two different methodologies that students are subject to. One is the federal methodology to figure out how much aid they might qualify for and what types. And then there's also the institutional methodology, where individual schools say, well, all right, that's great for the federal, but here's our formula based on the kinds of kids we want to attract.
Okay, so you mentioned that the student should help pay for school by working during high school, during college, both, anytime when they're 5 years old, maybe.
Did you work during high school and college, Carrie?
I did work a little bit during high school and most definitely during college.
What did you do?
I drove a limo.
Really?
Yeah.
I wasn't going to guess that. Actually,
honestly, I didn't drive a limo. I drove for a limousine company. I drove a luxury car for a limousine company.
This would be in Las Vegas?
No, it would be in Boston.
Nice.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I wouldn't have guessed that. We would have sat here for the next 45 minutes and I wouldn't have come up with that. So, yeah, it's usually a good idea for kids to get jobs, because it not only helps financially, but you get someone else yelling at them and holding them accountable for being there on time and doing the job correctly. So it hopefully teaches them some responsibility for it. But that's only true in college, in my opinion, if you really need the money and if you can get a good wage, better than minimum wage, and especially if you can find something in the field. Like, let's say your daughter wants to be a veterinarian and she gets a job helping out at the Humane Society or a veterinarian's office. That's fantastic because it not only gives her experience, but it teaches her about what the job will be like, and she hopefully earns a connection there that will help her once she graduates. Otherwise, it may be better off to forego the earnings and have the kid take a heavier class load and borrow the money that they could otherwise earn, because again, they might only be able to make $5,000 to $10,000 a year, maybe. And obviously, if they are, you know, cleaning up the bar at 3 o'clock in the morning, they have a test at 7 a.m. Right. that same morning, they're probably not going to do as well on that test. So they might be better off taking a heavier load, like 16 to 18 credits, and going to school in the summer and getting out sooner and saving those living expense costs and graduating with debt rather than trying to earn it as they go.
We are talking with Kevin McKinley about middle age and what you need to be saving for. We're talking right now in this portion of the program about college and how we are going to pay for college when our kids grow up. And we are taking your calls, 800-642-1234. You can also email onyourmoney@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Kathy from Madison, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I just have a quick question. I have two boys that are 4 years apart. One will be a freshman in college, and we have about a year saved for each one of them. And I'm wondering if it's better to put the 2 years on the first child and then save for the second one, or reserve those funds for the second child and just pay as we go for the first.
Interesting. Your answer, Kevin?
Well, I have to be careful about how I answer this because this call is not only available online through our shows at WPR.org, but it might be used by the younger child in therapy 20 or 30 years from now.
I was just going to say the same thing. All right. Okay.
Yeah, actually, Kathy, it's a good idea because oftentimes the money that you've accumulated for one kid might preclude need-based financial aid that you get for the other one. But have you used 529 plans like the EdVest account to save for these two kids?
Kathy, are you there? Sorry, we turned her down. Turned you back up, Kathy.
Yeah, no problem. Other parents, okay. and any parents with multiple children has this issue to some extent. Hopefully they have saved for both kids. I would not use the money first. We'll talk about this in a little bit, but I would rather have them borrow the money at first and use the savings for the last year for it, because you can always use that savings to pay for the final years. You can also use it for other expenses with a small penalty if it is in a 529 account. So I'd rather have them borrow the money, use that 1 year's worth of savings for the last year, not for the first one. And it gives you a better idea as to whether that first kid is even going to get all the way through school. And it's kind of a nice carrot for them to say, look, you get through the 3 years by borrowing money, working, whatever. We'll pay for your fourth and final year based on your savings account. So no, Kathy, I wouldn't exhaust those savings just on the first kid for lots of reasons.
Okay, good. Thank you, Kathy. I appreciate you calling. We are taking your calls this morning about college and about saving for your retirement. If you are squeezed in middle age, we want to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Email onyourmoney@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We had a caller, Karen from Eau Claire, says she's coming into $20,000, good for her. She has a truck she uses about 60% of the time for 4-H, so she can write off some of the interest. Should Karen pay off the truck, or is the savings in interest more valuable, and should she use the cash someplace else? Interesting question.
Yeah, the question that a lot of people have, not just about coming into money, but also they have extra money, hopefully, and they want to know, should they pay off the mortgage? And as a rule of thumb, you should not pay off any loan that has an interest rate of 6% or less. So that would usually include mortgages, car loans, if you have decent credit, and college education loans, because you're usually better off not putting that money aside and trying to earn more than 6%, but you're better off saving it for retirement, because when you save it into a pre-tax plan, you save yourself much more than that in the first year that you get that deduction on. So if you have $10,000, let's say, and you have an option between paying off a low interest rate car loan of, let's say, 3%, could be even lower if you can deduct part of the interest like Karen. But and then your other option is putting it into, let's say, a 401k or 403b. You might save yourself 15 to 25% of the deposit amount in taxes in the year in which you put that in your pre-tax plan. So that saves you, 4 or 5 years at least worth of interest cost, plus any earnings are sheltered from taxation. And then when you withdraw it in retirement, most people are in lower tax brackets in retirement, so the net savings is greater than paying off the loan. At the worst case scenario, what I'd like to see her do is just set the money aside in a checking account or short-term CD so it's immediately accessible, especially if she doesn't have any other savings, and then still make the payment. The interest generally does not drive people into bankruptcy, especially if it's 3 or 4 or 5%.
Right.
18 or 29 or 33, yeah, sure, those interest rates are hard to catch up with. But the lower interest rates don't. What usually causes people to run into trouble is they have an emergency expense they can't cover, or they lose their job and they can't cover their living expenses until they get back on their feet again and get a new job. So with that in mind, Karen, I'd rather have you save the money rather than pay off the loan.
Thank you very much, Karen. We've got Carl from Woodstock. Welcome to the program, Carl.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, how are you?
Fine, thank you. My question is this. I have an 8 and a 12-year-old. We're preparing to save for college. We have money coming from grandparents. They want to put it in a 529 plan, but we're concerned that if we put it in our name as a primary account holder, that we will then be penalized when it comes time to financial aid. And we're wondering if it should stay in grandparents' name or in parents' name.
No, I'd rather have it stay in the parents' name, because grandparents' 529 plans can actually hurt you even more than yours do. And plus, no offense to your grandparents, but once it's in your name, you have total control over the money. The grandparents don't have control over it, nor does the kid. If you keep it in the parents' name with the kid as the beneficiary, then you get to decide what to do with it. You don't have to wait about the grandparents changing their mind. And if they run into nursing home expenses at some point down the road, as long as it's been more than 5 years since the deposit was made, this won't be an attachable asset before they can receive public assistance for those expenses. So it's a good idea for them to put it in your name. And even then, it's a parental asset. So usually they only attach about 5 or 6% of the account value in the year in which you're applying for this. So let's say it's $50,000. They might only ask in the expected family contribution for about $2,500 to $3,000 of that $50,000 as part of the expected family contribution when they're figuring out your need-based aid. You're much better off worrying about control of it than you are worrying about need-based financial aid.
Thank you very much, Carl. We are taking your calls on the money this morning to talk about the squeeze that we feel here in middle age. And I'm plopping myself right in that category. We're squeezed between our kids who are going off to college sooner than we want. And we're also squeezed between our parents who are getting older. 800-642-1234 is the number that you can call us at. And you can also email onyourmoney@WPR.org, or you could tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to come back with Kevin McKinley and talk about the retirement portion of this. It's The Morning Show. It's the Morning Show. I'm Carrie Kaufman. We are talking to Kevin McKinley today about middle age and the squeeze that middle-aged people feel between their kids and their parents. This is an emotional squeeze for sure, but it's also a financial squeeze. And we are taking your calls to see how you are dealing with this. 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to talk about retirement here, Kevin. Saving for retirement. How do we do this? Where should we be at in the middle of our lives? Kevin?
Yes.
Oh, good.
A lot of people are trying to prioritize all of these expenses of paying for the mortgage and groceries and college. And usually saving for retirement after you kind of have your basics covered is the first place you should save because, again, you can borrow money for just about everything else that should come up, but you can't borrow money to retire. So I'd rather have people pay off high interest rate credit card debt. Otherwise, they're better off saving for retirement. And if you look at your own situation, you might feel like I'm just doing a terrible job. I'm not doing very well at all. But actually, the median amount, even for people in their 50s and 60s, saved for retirement is close to $100,000. And it's obviously much, much less than that. It's only a few hundred for people in their 20s and maybe a few thousand for people in their 30s and about $20,000 to $50,000 for people in their 40s and early 50s. But if you start now, and by now I don't mean later on this year or when your tax refund comes in, I mean starting today. If you're working, just call HR, go online, put the form in and start saving 10%. You'll be very thankful to your younger self when you're old down the road.
So where should we start? The at-work plan is the best way to do it?
Yeah, that's my favorite one just because it's so much easier to have money taken out of your paycheck rather than having to write the check and figure out where to invest it. Plus, you can get an employer match sometimes. You should save enough to at least get down to the 12% federal income tax bracket. That's anything that is a pre-tax plan contribution that brings your taxable income down generally below about $50,000 gross and about $100,000 for married couples filing jointly. So $50,000 for singles, $100,000 for married couples filing jointly. So if you make $60,000 and you're a single filer, you should try to contribute at least $10,000 to your pre-tax plan to get down to the 12% federal income tax bracket. Then if you have any money left over, move it to a Roth IRA. And once you've maxed out those contributions, if you're lucky enough to do that, then slide more money into your pre-tax plan because that usually gives you the biggest bang for the buck.
How should we invest this money? Where should it go?
If this is long-term money for your retirement and you haven't reached your goal of where you need to be, then you do need to be in the stock market. It's the best opportunity for growth, but you do need to accept that in any bad year, you could lose 30 or 40% of the money. That's
right.
Part of the give and take of being in the stock market. You want to use the lowest cost mutual funds you can find within your 401k. And again, if you're investing in the stock market for your longer-term money, like your 401k or your IRA, the Roth IRA, you might want to keep it safer because you might want to balance that out 50-50 between the stock market, maybe something safer like a CD or something that maybe only pays you 2 or 3%, but is not going to decline in value, and you can use it to rebalance if the stock fund should go down.
We are talking about middle age and the pressures of sending your kids to college while saving for your retirement, while dealing with your aging parents. The number to call is 800-642-1234. You can email onyourmoney at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Zoltan from Sheboygan, welcome to the program, Zoltan.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a question about investment into a condominium for my daughter in a college town 10 years prior to her college years and use it as an investment perhaps. And by the time she's ready to go to school, hopefully it will be paid for or the whole family will move into that condominium. She can go to college from home, basically.
So my question is, how do you know where your daughter's going to go to school?
Well, if she doesn't want to go there, perhaps, you know, I can sell the condominium and buy one, you know, wherever she wants to go.
Interesting. Kevin?
Yeah, that's the best laid plans of mice and men there, because if you want to guarantee one place that your kid isn't going to go to school, I would go ahead and buy a house in that particular place. And especially what happens a lot, if you buy a condo that makes sense in a school, and let's just take Madison for an example. If you buy a condo that's appropriate for school age, you're going to be competing with lots of other families who have lots of other monies that who can use it to bid the price up. So you're going to end up paying a lot of money for it. Condos generally don't have the same kind of price appreciation that would make you money on it. So there's a good chance you would buy it. And then if, you know, had you bought this in, let's say 2004, 2005, and then tried to sell the condo in 2008 or 9, you would have taken a bath on it. And so I'd much rather have you just park that money aside and keep all your options open for it, because the cost of actually maintaining and owning the condo, and especially with the condo, which not only has the purchase price, but it has property taxes and it has maintenance fees, are going to be so high that it's going to more than offset the value of purchasing it in advance. And if you do borrow the money for it, Zoltan, what you're going to see is, even once you get the mortgage for it, even at 4.5% interest, it's going to take 6 or 7 years before you really start making any headway into the principal by paying it off. So I think it's a good idea if you already have a place established the kid can live, but I wouldn't do it in this far in advance, and especially if you don't know where she's going to go to school.
Thank you very much, Zoltan. So I want to. You mentioned 2008. You mentioned taking a bath on maybe your home after the financial crisis. There are a lot of people who lost their retirements during that crisis, and they still can't necessarily afford to save for retirement. What do you tell them?
Yeah, well, they didn't lose it. It didn't go to zero, hopefully. I mean, it might have gone down a lot in value, 50 or 60%. But if they stuck with it and were able to keep contributing, that 50 or 60% decline was followed by a 300 or 400% return, depending on the type of investment over the 10 years. So it's a good example for people who are concerned about losing money, but also concerned about not having enough money, is if you are saving for retirement, you do have to ride these waves out. And especially when you're younger, if you can afford to contribute, those declines are actually helpful, because now your new money going in is going to be buying shares at lower prices than what it was before the crash. But for people who can't afford to save anymore, it's a good idea to cover the expenses. It's a good idea to pay off your mortgage if you can. And keep in mind, most of us will have Social Security. Some of us will have a pension. And a lot of times, once you get into your 60s, you'll find that the Social Security check actually provides you with more money than you lived on for many of your working years, net of all your other expenses like paying the mortgage or mouths to feed, etc.
Interesting. We are taking your calls here on The Morning Show. We're talking about the financial squeeze that we find ourselves in at middle age. 800-642-1234 or on your money at WPR.org. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that we needed to talk about how to protect ourselves from fraud. We had a question about that earlier. How vast is financial fraud, and what should we be looking for, Kevin?
The fear is probably greater than the actual crime, but it's still something that's relatively easy to prevent. And if you don't take some simple steps, the problem can not only magnify itself once it does come to fruition, but it's very difficult to get back out of it for it. And again, because we're talking about middle-aged adults here, many times we have adult children who aren't as diligent about their own identity and their finances. And you might be caring for an older adult who's not up to speed or can't take care of things themselves. So it's a good idea to learn how to protect not only your own financial and personal identity information, but theirs as well.
And we're still hearing a lot about identity theft. Are there ways to prevent identities from being stolen?
Yeah, don't give out your Social Security number if you can help it. Anytime someone asks for your Social Security number, say, why do you need this? And if they don't give you a satisfactory answer, or if you can do business with them without giving your Social Security number, try to avoid it. Number one way to prevent identity theft from hurting you, though, is to freeze your credit report. What that means is you lock up your credit information, so even if someone does get your Social Security number, they can't open a credit card or borrow money in your name, creating a problem for you down the road. Usually when that crime happens, you are not liable for the theft, but it can be, the money can be sold to debt collectors in the time between when it happens and when you discover it. And so once it's sold to a debt collector, it's out forever, and you can get a call 10 years later saying, hey, we bought your debt, you owe us $10,000, give it to us now, or we're going to take you to small claims court next week. So freeze your credit report, and to learn how to do that, go to tinyurl.com/credfreeze. That's a separate link that we've set up that takes you to the Consumer Reports information on freezing your credit report. There is legislation out right now that would allow people to freeze their credit reports nationwide for free. It hasn't been enacted yet, but I think it will. In the meantime, if you want to do it for yourself and your family, you might end up paying about $10 to freeze it per bureau, so it might cost you about $30. But the terms are different in every state, and it can be different for every bureau. So again, tinyurl.com/credfreeze, and we'll have a link to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com.
Okay, and online information. The caller earlier talked about what should she get paper, or should she do pay her bills online? What do we need to do to go totally online?
The first thing is good passwords. Make sure you have something that's secure. 1234 and password or anything like that that can be guessed relatively easily is not a good password. Better off, go to howsecureismypassword.net, howsecureismypassword.net, and you can put in your password in, but if you prefer to keep your specific password private, then you want to put in some kind of proxy. Like, let's say your password is Bluebell58. Well, you could change it to Redbell58 and to see, that'll tell you how long it would take what they call a brute hack. That's when they just have a computer just going at trying all different kinds of permutations of a password for it. You might want to look at a password manager. Like, I think Dashlane is one that that a lot of people are happy with. And you definitely want to have antivirus software so that if they try to get in your computer and put software in that can log your keys or can get you to go to malicious websites or all that can protect you, do it. And finally, do not click on emails from any institution. The link's in there. If it says it's coming from Chase Bank or your local credit union, don't click on the link inside of the email. Instead, if you get a notification that looks legitimate, go to that specific institution's website directly. I mean, going to Google, type in, make sure it's the right one before you log into it. And definitely do not download anything whatsoever. Don't open any attachments, and hopefully your antivirus software will prevent you from doing that.
We are taking your calls for On the Money. Kathy from Oconomowoc, welcome to the program. Kathy?
Hello?
Yes, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. Wondering if Edvest for like an 8-year-old grandson is good investment for college.
Yeah, Edvest is usually the primary way to saving for college, especially for grandparents. For Wisconsin residents, you get a small tax break on the deposit, not a big one. But the more important thing is, Kathy, is you get to keep control over the money. You can name the grandchild as the beneficiary, but you can decide if and when to give him the money for college. And the earnings in the 529 account, there's a roster of investments. It's kind of like your mutual fund plan you might have in your 401k at work. And you can pick from a different roster. And then hopefully if it makes money, and then when you pull it out, if the money's used for qualified higher education expenses, which are a pretty liberal definition, room and board, but books, tuition, computer supplies if mandated, et cetera, it's a tax-free distribution, and if for some reason you either don't want to help the kid out or you can't afford to, you need that money, you don't have to actually give that money to the kid. You can use it yourself. If you use it for something other than qualifying higher education expenses, you will pay taxes and a small penalty on whatever earnings that account accumulated, but that's still a relatively small portion of the total value.
Thank you very much, Kathy. Jason and Nina called earlier. He says he emptied his daughter's 529 account and used savings for her first 2 years of college. He says that after that, his daughter had to take responsibility and pay for it. Her grades got better once she took ownership of it. Jason says he realizes kids need to have obligations to learn accountability.
Right, and that kind of sticks with what I mentioned before about using a 529 account for the last few years. Now, kids hopefully mature relatively quickly during college, and we don't know if she would have been responsible, but if he would have said, hey, I'll make you a deal. You get through the first 2 years, get good grades, keep a B average or whatever on your own dime by borrowing all the money or earning it, and then I will pay for the last 2 years. Maybe she would have snapped to it even a little earlier, but you never know. Good parenting advice, Carrie, you can probably back me up on this, that I received a long time ago when my kids were young, is just remember their brains aren't fully formed until they're 25 years old.
Mm-hmm. That is true, and I'm not going there. Catherine from Racine, welcome to the program.
Good morning. I have a question about converting Series E bonds that date from 1996 to a Roth IRA. What is your opinion?
So these are savings bonds?
Yes, savings.
Yeah, you can't really convert them to a Roth IRA. What you can do is cash them in, and if you have earned income, you can then make a contribution to a Roth IRA. But I'm guessing you don't have any earned income, like earnings that you actually worked for, correct?
No, I'm retired.
Okay. No, then you can't make a contribution to a Roth IRA. And quite frankly, I would just as soon not have you cash those in because you're still earning money on that. They pay interest for 30 years, right, Catherine?
Yes, they do.
And do you know what the interest rate is on those?
Some of them are paying interest 2.06, and about half the rest are 1.52.
Okay. In that case, you may want to cash them in, and you may want to move them to a CD, because right now if you shop around, you can find five-year CDs nationwide for about 3% or so. The difference is you're going to have to pay taxes on the savings bond interest if you haven't declared the interest every single year, but that's going to be paid sooner or later by someone, so you might as well do it now and maybe move it into something that has a better interest rate.
Great. Thank you very much, Catherine. Margaret, near Racine, welcome to the program.
Hi. My question is, what is the earliest age that you can do the five-year snapshot at? I am going to be 60 in January. I have learned through helping my parents that by doing nothing, that's not a good thing. They were wonderful investors, but they never did anything to protect their assets. So I do own my own property. I am almost debt-free. I just have a small line of credit that I will put something on just to have something that looks like I'm paying on it. I have no other debt, but I do own a piece of property that I could sell and build a small house for myself for the future. What's my best plan here? As far as can I do a five-year snapshot now, and where do I put the things that look like assets so they don't actually look like my assets? Is that possible?
Not really. Margaret, your questions are well-intentioned, but I'm not going to have good news for you. The first one is that the five-year snapshot means that if you apply for, let's say, a nursing home and you want public assistance, there's a look-back period where they look at anything you did in the previous 5 years from that application point to see if you gave away money to try to qualify for public assistance that you otherwise wouldn't deserve. And I would much rather have you keep those properties in your name. Maybe you can put them in a trust, but even then, you have to remember, the majority of people do not go to a nursing home. Your parents' experience notwithstanding, their stays in nursing homes are relatively short and relatively inexpensive compared to their big picture. Even a stay that's, 11 months or so or 12 months might cost $100,000. Well, in many people's cases, that's the value of their home that they sold and by definition don't need anymore. So you can buy long-term care insurance. You can give away all of your assets and then sit and wait to go to the nursing home, but that doesn't sound like a very enjoyable retirement. We are going to talk more about this next week, but no, I would have you talk with an attorney to have him or her look at your situation, but there's really not much you can do. That's the bad news. The good news is it's unlikely that you will go to a nursing home and stay there long enough where you would otherwise qualify for public assistance.
Thank you very much, Margaret. We have been talking about the middle-age generation financially and how we are squeezed between our kids going to college, between our own retirement, and between our parents who are aging. Kevin McKinley is with us every Tuesday for the rest of the month. Kevin, what is the website of the week?
Well, we talked, Gary, about freezing your credit report. If you want to get a free look at your credit report, the raw data, to see if there are any errors that could be costing you money, go to annualcreditreport.com. You get one report per bureau per year. Annualcreditreport.com. We'll have a link to that website at our website onyourmoney.com later on today.
And four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley, thank you very much. The Morning Show is produced by Colleen Leahy, Brianne Shasso, Chris Molina, Laura Pavin, and Sarah Hopeful. Michael Derringer is our technical director. Keely Boltina is the executive producer. I'm Carrie Kaufman, and this is The Ideas Network.